This week, I want to start our message by talking about a story someone shared with me from the social work field about 5 or 6 years ago. And the story goes like this, that many years ago, there was a town that was on the bank of a river. And the town used this river for all sorts of things, to carry about the daily commerce of their life, for water, you know, to sustain them, obviously for, you know, taking a bath or cooking food or doing all this kind of stuff as a part of just life. And unfortunately, there was a problem with the river. And the problem was that at the bank of the river, it wasn't just a town, there was also an ogre that had made its home on the banks of the river. And the ogre did what ogres do. It wounded people, injured people. It would attack people as they would go and try to get some water from this river, and it would throw people into the river, and people would float downriver until eventually they would land on the banks of the river next to another town downstream. People in this second town downstream would see people in the river and would try and fish them out and help nurse them back to health and help them recover. And of course, over the process of that time, they would ask the question, what happened? You know, what is going on here? And the people would tell them about this ogre that lived upstream, and they would receive all kinds of sympathy and stuff from these people in the second town as they would help nurse them back to health. Now, the story stops there, and the story stops there, I think, to make a really critical yet unspoken point. And the point is this. It is a very noble thing to nurse the hurting, the wounded, whomever, back to health. That is a good thing. But the reason this is a social work story is because it's here to make the point that good social work doesn't just help nurse people back to health. It goes upstream and it deals with the ogre. Right? It doesn't just treat the symptoms of a problem. It treats the actual problem. And of course, to go upstream, it's going to be a lot harder, right? It's a lot easier to nurse people back to health than it is to, you know, beat an ogre. I don't exactly know what goes into that, right? But I know it's complicated. I know it requires planning. I know it requires courage, right? But the point of the story is good social work will use all of those things, not just to help people who are hurting, but to conquer the problems that cause them to be hurting in the first place. Today, I want to talk about what I think is the biggest enemy to us being rich and what matters most, and it's a four-letter word, debt. Debt. I want to talk about how can we dig out of debt. And I think one of the things that I do when I talk about this with people, to our detriment, is I get focused on the symptoms. I talk about the strategies for how to get out of debt, and those are important, and we're going to do those today, so don't worry, okay? But if we do all those things without actually talking about why do we get here in the first place? I think we're kind of like the people in that story. We live downstream of the problem and solve the wrong problem. And so today, I want to do that. Why do we get into debt? Why do we spend more than we make? I think there's a few reasons. We should probably start by saying, hey, sometimes we end up in a place like that because of a crisis in our life, because we hit something hard that we just can't overcome. This is my family's story about a year ago. Before we moved here, you know, I was out of work. My wife had gotten a lot of hours reduced at her workplace, and we were probably about 2 weeks away from asking our in-laws, hey, can you get that guest bedroom ready for us? Because we just hit something that, even with our financial planning and doing a pretty good job in that we'd kind of done that long enough that, you know, we're just a few weeks away from having to, you know, take some pretty drastic measures. And so certainly for some of us, we find ourselves there for that reason. But I think as you look at statistics, as you look at stuff around debt, right, a lot of the reason isn't crisis, or at least it didn't start as a crisis. It comes back to a number of issues, right? Some of us, we find ourselves in debt because we lack self-control. You know, we struggle to say no to ourselves or our spouse or our kids or whomever it might be. Some of us find ourselves in debt because we're just unwise. We don't connect our financial actions in the here and now with how they might affect us tomorrow. I have a friend who told me about when he was in college, he figured out about like halfway through his freshman year that he could leverage his student loan to purchase anything from the college bookstore, which was unfortunate because you could buy just about anything at the college bookstore. And my friend ended his 4-year undergraduate degree with almost $100,000 in debt. And he would tell you, that's very unwise. Okay, if you're a college student in this room or going to college, grad school, anything, be aware. You know, be very wise in the way you use that. Some of us find ourselves in debt because, you know, we're just unaware of what we're doing. About a year and a half ago, my wife and my sister-in-law went out to coffee, and at some point, there was like a financial thing happening in my sister-in-law's life, And my wife was asking her about it, and she started to ask her, well, do you have a budget? You know, this has kind of become a pet issue for us and trying to help people get well financially, because we know it's a really stressful, anxiety-producing thing for many of us. And my sister-in-law sheepishly admitted, well, no. And so my wife does what my wife does. She pulled out a napkin at Starbucks and starts sketching out expenses. You know, she's just about ready to do a pivot table probably or something like that, you know, help people. And what was interesting is over the course of that conversation, my sister-in-law started to put together, oh, wow, like for the first time she's connecting how, hey, this expense here actually affects me in paying my rent at the end of the month. You know, she knew that theoretically, but she hadn't connected the dots on that. And I think she's not alone, right? I've done that, you've done that, right? We sometimes are just unaware. But honestly, I think if we dive beneath all of those issues, and this isn't every single situation, and this isn't every single person, but I think there's a heart issue oftentimes that lies between us and our spending. And the heart issue is not one we talk about a lot, but it's one I think is really important to talk about. And the heart issue is greed. Greed. And the way I want to define greed for us today is it's the assumption that it's all for my consumption. Okay? Greed kind of looks and says, everything that comes my way is going to be for me or for mine, right? For me or my family or me and my friends or that kind of thing. Like, it basically just says, everything that comes my way is for me to decide what I do. And what's interesting about greed is it's a very interesting, like, it's a multifaceted issue. It's a heart issue. It's kind of squishy, you know, like, it's not something that you can just point at and figure out, like, oh, yeah, you know, obviously, that's greed. One of the things that I think is worth noting for us about greed is that greed is really hard to see in the mirror. I've been in a ministry position with a church since 2008, so 10 years. I've done that full-time since 2009. I've had a lot of conversations with people about a lot of different things, a lot of spiritual stuff, a lot of next steps conversations, all you name it, okay? In that 10-year period, I've had one conversation with someone who said, Wes, you know what? I think I have a problem with greed. And you know why that is? I don't think it's because I've only had one conversation with a greedy person. I think it's because greed is one of those things that's really easy for me to see in someone else. It's really hard for me to notice in myself. Second thing that's interesting about greed is greed presents differently in different people. Okay, so some of you, when I say greed, the first image you think of is just like someone totally spendthrift. They're just throwing money left and right, doing whatever, buying all the stuff that they don't need, all this sort of thing. And maybe that's your image of greed, and that could be. Some of us, when we think about greed, we think about, I remember like the cartoon with Scrooge McDuck, and he's in the dark, and he's counting his coins. He's got, like, the candlelight, and he's very miserly as he counts his mountain of gold that he's got right next to him. And we think about that miserly kind of image about greed. What's interesting is both of those, I think, can be manifestations of greed, because they're basically the same attitude. One says, hey, I'm going to spend stuff for me now, and the other attitude says, I'm going to spend stuff for me later. Now, I'm not against spending. I'm also not against saving, right? Like, that's where this gets tricky, right? Where's the line? When do we cross that? But here's the thing, is greed can show itself in our lives in both of those different ways. And we just need to be aware of that. We need to be cognizant of that. And what's interesting is with greed, if greed is a heart attitude, that everything exists for me, what that means is I can be greedy without having very much money. Right, like, I don't need margin to be greedy, right? Because if greedy is just a, hey, everything that comes my way is for me, like, I can do that with a lot of money, a little money, and everything in between. Third thing that's worth noting about greed is this. Greed often masquerades as need. So I don't know if I'm the only one in the room. I can't imagine, though. But I found something in my life that I needed in the moment, and then I bought it, and I realized how worthless or silly it really was. Okay, this is Super Bowl weekend, yeah. I'm sure that Target and Best Buy and all these places across our city this week have probably been full of people buying that new TV. You know, and I'm not against having a nice TV, right? I'm all for that. Again, like I said last week, it's Super Bowl, right? You want to be able to see the players on your screen just as large as they were in real life, okay? That's the whole goal of the Super Bowl. And that's great. But the thing is that what advertisers do is they present everything to us as if it's a need. I need this car, I need this phone, I need this TV, I need this status symbol or this thing to make me happy, right? No, you've never seen a commercial that says, hey, everything you have is fine. You know, you're doing great. You know, hey, keep driving that 92 Volkswagen Beetle. Okay, that's a great car, and don't even think about purchasing this one. You know, like, that's not how you make a buck, right? That's not how our economy, how our world is structured, okay? And so it masquerades as need, and we kind of buy into that sometimes. Now, all this said about greed, Jesus has some stuff to say about greed. And in a first century document written by a guy named Luke, who made it his goal to show his audience, to show even us today, who Jesus was, what Jesus taught, all the stuff that eyewitnesses and people around Jesus reported about Jesus, Luke records for us a number of places where Jesus talks about money and possessions and greed. And today I want to look at one of those. And it comes from this document, Luke chapter 12. And the scene begins this way. Someone in the crowd, Jesus is teaching. Jesus kind of gets to a point where he pauses. And someone in the crowd pipes up and says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And Jesus replied, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbiter between you? Hey, this is not my job, dude." You know, which is kind of interesting. This guy doesn't say, "Hey, Jesus, help us figure this out." This guy says, "Hey, Jesus, can you be on my side?" You know, which is kind of something I'm prone to do with Jesus every once in a while. And then Jesus notices something. You know, we talked about last week how Jesus has that spiritual X-ray vision where he can kind of see through into my heart and he can see what I'm really struggling with. And I think he has one of those moments with this guy in the crowd. And he says to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, because life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions." Now, Jesus says to his audience, guys, I want you to take note. Luke, grab your pen, man. Okay, write this down. Watch out for greed. Watch out. Okay, I thought about, what's the stuff in my life I'm on my guard against, or stuff I watch out for all the time? Okay, when someone tries to sell me something, I get on my guard. You know, when you're walking through the mall and the guy's like trying to get your attention at the, you know, perfume counter or something like that. You know, like, hey, I'm not interested. You know, I'm on my guard whenever I watch like a political candidate on TV or like a political pundit make a comment. You know, I'm always trying to poke a hole in their argument. You know, I'm always trying to see the other side because I don't believe anything anyone says on TV, you know, or in the paper or wherever. Sometimes when I'm running at night, which I'm sure you're like, "Wow, Wes, you're such a runner. Tell me your secret, man. You have such a runner's body. That's a beautiful beer belly you have right there." When I go running at night, I'm on my guard. I'm watching out. I'm trying to stay on lit streets. I'm watching for, you know, if anyone's on my left or right. You know, I don't want someone like come up behind me and mug me or something like that. Yeah, I'm on my guard, okay? Jesus says that same on your guard thing that you carry into different environments of your life, you need to carry into the way that you think about greed. Like, you need to be just as on guard. And I think part of the reason is because it's subtle, man. It just sneaks in there. It's silent. It doesn't come loud and advertising itself, right? It's little by little me buying into the lie that my life consists of my stuff, right? That the more I have, the better I am. Jesus says a good life is not built on the altar of more and better, right? Your standard of living is not directly connected to your quality of life. Some of you have experienced this. You've went to a third world country on a mission trip or something like that, and you've seen people who live on a dollar or two a day and have way more joy than people who live here in America, where, you know, we're like the richest nation in the world. And likewise, we could go 100 yards from this building, and I'm sure we could find someone who they're just so ridiculously unhappy with their life, but man, they got the nicest apartment. They got the coolest cars. they hate their marriage, but they got nice cars. You know, and that's like, man, those things aren't connected, right? You have a great standard of living. That doesn't mean you have an awesome quality of life, right? Because our life does not consist in just what we own and just our possessions. And then to illustrate this point, Jesus is going to tell a story. Jesus tells a parable. He says, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest, and he thought to himself, 'Well, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' So then he said, 'Here's what I'll do. I will tear down my barns, build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain.'" Okay, so far, this guy's good, right? He's got a problem all of us would love to have. Oh my gosh, I have too many things. I have no place to store them. I'm going to build, a bigger structure to hold my stuff, okay? But this is where he goes askew. I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, be merry, okay? This guy's last statement is the first century version of treat yourself, okay? That's like the first century version of, you know, it's time, guys. Like, I'm done. I'm hanging it up. You know, greatest grain harvester ever right here. You know, I'm just hanging it up, okay? And it's time to treat yourself, right? I'm going to buy that house in Cancun, or I'm going to, you know, I don't know what he's going to do, okay? But he's basically saying, I'm done. I got enough. I'm good. I got plenty of stuff for me. You know, let's get out of here. Now, I'm not against treating yourself, okay? I'm just trying to say, treat yourself. This is like the most treat yourselves in the sermon ever, probably. I'm not against that. I don't think Jesus is against that. But here's the problem that Jesus observes that we would be, you know, good to see. Is the minute my thinking on my stuff, on my money, turns to, hey, this is all for me, that's a red flag. What's interesting is this guy, all the riches, all the wealth, all the possessions he has, that's a gift from God. Like, we could say that about all the money and stuff we earn. This guy, literally, his wealth is invested in grain, right? Like, he did nothing to help this grow. Yeah, he planted the seed, he did all the stuff you have to do, but, like, you know, it could have been a drought. You know, like, God has literally provided this for him. And what's interesting about that is, without God's provision, this guy would have no room to be greedy, right? So if our assumption is, well, God let me get it, so he must want me to spend it all on me. Well, hey, that's apparently incorrect, according to Jesus. Second thing to note here, did you see when this guy talked? Did you notice who the focus of his attention and his energy was? I'm just going to paraphrase and read back to you all the stuff he says in the story. What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. I'll say to myself that I have plenty of stuff stored up, so I will take it easy. Okay, I counted. This guy says 52 words in the story. 12 of them are I, me, my. Okay, 22% of this guy's speech is literally all about him, all about his. Right? You know what we call a person who does that? Self-absorbed. Have you ever met a person that's like, hey, I love talking to Lucy because, like, it's always all about her. You know, like, no one likes to hang around a self-absorbed person. And that's exactly what this guy is. When the Bible, when God talks to us about greed, what's interesting is it's almost always linked with this sin of idolatry. And all idolatry is saying, hey, I'm going to kick God out of the center stage of my life. I'm going to insert myself there or something else there. And what greed is this just one of the ways that we can kick God out of the center stage of our life and install ourselves there, to put ourselves in the middle of our life. And Jesus apparently doesn't take very kindly to this. Jesus is going to make this illustration for us that apparently in the way of Jesus, if a significant percentage of what I receive from God is just going to me, but isn't going through me to bless other people, well, hey, I'm a poster child for greed. I have a red flag. I have a problem, Jesus says. And he wraps up the parable by sharing this. God said to him, this guy in the story, you fool, right? We'd say, you idiot, what are you doing, man? This very night, your life will be demanded from you. Then who's going to get what you've prepared for yourself? And the implied answer is, not you. Not you. This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves that isn't rich toward God. All right, Jesus is saying, you can chase after greed for all you're worth, but in the end, you'll have nothing of worth to show for it. Right? You're going to get to the end of the line, and you're going to realize how meaningless and pointless all the stuff in the world is to you. You're going to get to the end and realize, man, this thing made a promise that it didn't deliver on, is what Jesus says. And Jesus asks, I think, a really poignant question, a question that I think is worth us wrestling with together, which is, does my life consist in the abundance of all I own and possess? Does your life consist in all the abundance of what you own and possess? Is your life your stuff? And I think all of us initially would kind of say, no, of course not. Of course not. You know, and we know that mentally, or at least we want to say the right answer. No one wants to say, yeah, my life is my stuff. But in my heart, and in the way I act and the way I kind of carry my life around, I'm not always so sure. I had a conversation with someone after a message last week where we were talking about my dad would always use this phrase sometimes growing up where he would say, son, I just want you to have it better off than how I had it. And what's interesting is when my dad would use that phrase, it almost always meant like stuff and money. You know, and my dad grew up in kind of like a lower middle class family. You know, like I understand what he's saying. He doesn't want me to have to go through some of the struggles he and his family went through, which I appreciate. But I think it's really interesting, right? Like I just think that's kind of an interesting statement that sort of illustrates that, right? We see these things as maybe a little bit more interconnected than we should. Here's the thing, guys. We're going to turn the conversation to, you know, how can we move out of debt? How can we dig out? But here's the one thing I want you to take away. All you need to get out of debt is a bunch of self-control, right? Like there's nothing uniquely Christian about getting out of debt. Christians can do it. Non-Christians can do it. You can be of another faith and do it. You know, like all you need is some self-control and a plan, okay? But here's what's interesting. If you don't deal with greed, you might get out of debt, but you will never be rich in what matters most. You know, like, God isn't going after debt-free people. God is going after people who will be rich in what matters most. People who, as Jesus says at the end of the story, people who will not just be rich toward themselves, but also rich toward God and toward God's interests in this world. People who will allow stuff not just to come to them, but also be worked through them to be a blessing to the world that God loves. So how we dig ourselves out of debt? Well, step one, we spent 20 minutes talking about, you know, God deal with greed. Okay, step two, I promise it won't take 20 minutes to talk about. Step two, you need to make a spending plan. This is that dreaded B word, budget, all right? Budget, oh my gosh. Yeah. Some of you might as well have said, get a root canal because that's how exciting it probably feels, okay? I'm a really big believer in budgets for several reasons. For one, I think a budget's really great because it shows you if you're trying to do a fool's errand or not. Here's the fact. All of us spend a percentage of what we make. Some of us in this room spend 90%. Some of us spend 80%. We may spend 110%, okay? Here's what I can guarantee you. I am not an economist. I have no economic training. Do not ask me for anything about the financial world or financial markets. But this I can promise you. If you spend 110% of your income, you will never get out of debt. I feel pretty confident in making that statement, okay? You are not the federal government. You can't take a vote and go, now we have more, you know, or something like that. That would be great that, you know, life worked that way, right? That's the truth about your situation. That's the truth about my situation. Information I'm not aware of doesn't mean it doesn't apply. It just means I'm not aware of it, right? So the wise thing to do is to make myself aware, and a spending plan does that. Second thing a spending plan does is it also helps me see where I can create margin. In the story about my sister-in-law earlier, you know, making a spending plan helped her connect the dots on, oh, wow, yeah, like I actually can cut a couple things out, and that will help me hit my rent at the end of the month. You know, it will help me make this expense. It will help me save for this car that I'm trying to get to replace my old one right now, okay? Those are things a spending plan equips you to do. And honestly, the most important thing a spending plan equips you with is peace, okay? If you're in this room and you're married or dating someone and your financial lives are kind of intermixed, you may be like totally anti-plan, and you're not a type A person, you're not a let's write it down person. I guarantee you though, if that's you, you're probably married or with someone who's the exact opposite, okay? In our family, I know if we went without a spending plan, it would just be like utter chaos. It would just be fight central, right? Because we need a plan, okay? And so you might be surprised at the relief that walks into the room as you kind of sit down and say, how are we going to spend? How are we going to do this? How are we going to work this out? If you're in college, if you're a grad student, and you're still single, I mean, figure this out now, right? It's going to set you up really, really well for a great relationship or great marriage in the future to make a spending plan. And then we get to step three, which is the hard one. You got to get rid of your non-essentials. Got to get rid of your non-essentials. In this life, I think all of us have four essentials. If you're a follower of Jesus, I would make the argument you have five, okay? Five essential things. Food, shelter, clothing, and transportation. Okay, and if you're a Christian, I'd say, hey, my commitment to honor God with my financial life is up there as well. But regardless, anything beyond those five things is not absolutely essential. So this makes me very sad when I was in debt, but new clothes are not an essential. Clothes are an essential. New ones are not. Golf is not an essential. DirecTV is not an essential, right? This is the really hard one, right? Ballet lessons or soccer or whatever, you know, 100 or 200 bucks I have to pay to sign up my kid for this activity, right? That's not an essential, okay? There are a lot of things in our lives that are not essentials. Drinks after work with my coworkers, not an essential, okay? And if you want to find your way out of debt, you have to get honest with yourself and cut out some of the stuff that isn't an essential. I know someone here at Crossbridge, the last time we talked about finances, he had some student loan debt he was paying off. And he talked about how, yeah, you know what? I heard what you said. I decided, you know what? I'm going to get rid of all my non-essentials so I can do it right. And let me tell you, he ate a lot of turkey and cheese sandwiches over the course of his, you know, whatever, because it was literally bare bones scraping it together, man. I'm sending as much money as I possibly can to pay off a debt. And guess what? In 2 or 3 months, he had it, right? Because he's throwing like everything he's got at this problem. I was like, wow, that's impressive, man. But the idea is, hey, you and I can't have the same spending rhythms that we enjoy now, and magically we're going to get more money to get us out of debt, right? Like, that's not the way it works. I wish it did. It doesn't. So I have to be honest about what isn't essential. The second thing we have to be honest about is we got to sell what we aren't using. We have to sell what isn't used, okay? For some of us, you've got an entire bedroom in your house that's become the junk area, okay? We have a guest bedroom in our home. And if I'm really honest, the guest bedroom isn't for guests. The guest bedroom is for all the stuff and all the music equipment that I have from college that I just haven't been able to get rid of or been too lazy to eBay. Apparently, 2 or 3 of you have the same problem I do, right? Where you've got an entire garage or entire shed or entire something or other that's just got all kinds of stuff you don't use. Some of you, the whole reason you got a guest bedroom was so you could have a second master closet, you know, and that's just basically what that's become, okay? If you got stuff you aren't using, it's time to sell it, right? You got to raise some capital if we're going to get out of debt. I love this saying from financial expert Dave Ramsey. He says, if you're getting out of debt, you should be selling so much stuff your kids are afraid they're next, man. Like, that's the next thing. You know, that's a good way to live. You know, Billy, better eat that broccoli. I don't know. Yeah, might be out of here soon, you know, just like all this other stuff. So just got to sell what isn't needed. And then the last thing is I'd encourage you and downgrade to what's more economical. If you have a car with a $400 car payment, it's time to look at what can I do to get one with a $200 one or a $100 one or even better, a $0 one because I was able to pay for it, right? If I have a home that has, you know, a bedroom, a guest bedroom that no one uses and under 10 times a year someone is actually sleeping in it, I should probably look into seeing if maybe it's time to downgrade that, right? You're living on that bed after the big fights. So it could be in the interest of your marriage, you know, to get rid of that, okay, to downsize that. Basically, hey, I'm looking for places wherever I have margin, and by downgrading, I could actually free myself up with some cash, right? Some of you, the downgrade you need to make is instead of $2.19 at Starbucks every morning, it's Starbucks at home, you know, for way less than that, right? I'm not telling you to cut out coffee. I'm telling you, change where you have it. You know, like find ways where I can create the margin. And that gets us to the last part, which is the fun part, is snowball your debt. I've kind of showed you this example before. This is one that a number of places have talked about. But once you figure out how much you've got left, how much you can dig out with each month, it's time to do the hard work of digging out. So we have this little chart up here. You know, I found it just someone sharing their example from their life online. But you see there, they've got 5 accounts. And what they do, they found $200. They pay the minimum on everything except for the smallest payment. And so they're going to work hard on that. They're going to take care of Target in a month or two there. And then they're going to roll that over into their Shell account. And then they're going to pay, I assume that's Shell gas station, not like, you know, Shell fund in the Cayman Islands or something like that. If they have one of those, they probably don't need to pay these off. But anyway, they're going to move that all into there. They're going to keep chipping away at that with that $225 plus the $40 minimum. They're just going to keep doing that. They get, you know, extra money at tax return time or mom helps them out with something, they're going to do that, okay? They're just going to keep chipping away at this thing until it's gone. Now, some of you in this room, I know you're kind of like, Wes, I know debt's not good. I know at some point I got paid off, you know, whatever. But it works for us. You know, like, we're good. You know, we figured out a new rhythm. We're fine. You know, like, what's the big deal? Okay. Just a couple things on that. If you're a Christian, it is a really big deal. You know, open up the scriptures, right? You're going to see that. But even beyond that, beyond the spiritual reason, that family in that example is spending almost like $7,600 a year that they're giving to a company or a corporation that doesn't even know what their name is, right? To, you know, I guarantee you the MasterCard, they're not Jim and Pam Smith. It's, you know, customer 0XY121276, you know, and I don't mind credit. You know, it's great. One day I'm going to buy a house. I'm going to need some credit for that. You know, if our church ever purchases something big, you know, we're going to need credit for that. So I'm fine with credit. But the idea is, why would I throw away $7,000 or $8,000 a year to someone who doesn't even know my name? Yeah, the interest on all those payments is probably $1,000 a year, right? When you add that all together, it's like $8,500, $8,600 a year that they're just giving to people who don't even know their name, except for, you know, they had a loan from mom and dad. So hopefully mom and dad know their names, you know? But the image is, man, you've worked hard for that. I work hard for that. I want to be able to be rich in the way that I choose to, and what I discern matters most, right? Not what MasterCard discerns matters most, not what Target discerns matters most, not what Shell or Honda or whoever it is decides matters most, but man, and the stuff that I decide matters most, right? Like, that's huge. Could you imagine if you're in debt, like just the feeling of that low level of anxiety you carry all the time of like, oh no, you know, or if something happens financially that you're worried about, like, could you just imagine living your life with that gone? Like, hey, we could, you know, something could happen, and you know what? I'm not worried, because $1,000 of my income isn't already spent before the month even begins, right? Like, how amazing would that be, right? That kind of peace that could come from that. I want you to experience that. God wants you to experience that. I want you to know what it is to feel the peace of that happening. I want you to know the awesome experience of being rich in the stuff that matters the most. Let me pray for us to experience and see that happen for us. God, I thank you so much for the common sense wisdom from Scripture. And God, I just pray for those of us who are facing a pretty big financial hurdle, or God, maybe facing a crisis or something that we're struggling to dig out from. Father, it's my prayer that you would help us be self-controlled and disciplined. It's my prayer that you would help us to deal with the greed or consumerism or materialism that lives within us, many of us just because of a byproduct of the culture in which we find ourselves. God, help us to take a stand and to be rich in what matters most. Help the people in this room to find the freedom that comes from being rich in what matters most. God, help us honor you and the way we structure our lives financially. We pray this in Christ's awesome and perfect name. Amen.